Good afternoon. I'm Elise Thatcher, and this is Spotlight Health from Aspen Public Radio, our series on critical health issues. Today, we'll talk with two guests about the value of truly being yourself, even when it's challenging or dangerous.
For every action or inaction, there is a price to pay. We just have to make up our mind, which is easier, which is more challenging.
Our second guest takes a look at how embracing who you are can pay off.
All of the amazing things I've had the privilege of doing over the last 10 years of my life, none of them should have happened.
That's coming up on Spotlight Health. BC Alimi is an LGBT and HIV activist. He lives in London but is originally from Nigeria. In 2004, Alimi came out on national television in his home country. Ultimately, he was forced to leave because of homophobia and physical threats. I asked him what he learned from that experience. We spoke by Skype.
I think one I've learned from the process is that if there's something that needed to be said, you have to say it. And that nothing comes without a price. Not doing something actually also has a price. And you just have to choose. You have to determine how far you want to go when it comes to risk. It was, for me, a life-changing experience. And I always tell people, and like I will also say to you, I'm here having this conversation with you because I took that decision in 2004. That was 12 years ago. I took that crazy decision to come out on national television. Yes, my life has changed. My career has ended. But I've been given a better opportunities in life to be able to stand up and speak up for so many people, including myself. So basically, it's what it has taught me, that for every action or inaction, there is a price to pay. We just have to make up our mind, which is easier, which is more challenging.
Why be openly gay when you were there? What prompted you in the moment to do that? Because it was a very hard place to be out, right? You faced physical violence for it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, the option that I have is to put up with the injustice or to speak out. But I also say this, and I know a lot of people have questioned why I say that. Coming out that day, I wasn't coming out to speak for people. That was not why I was doing that. I was coming out to save my soul. And coming out that day didn't just happen on that sofa. It was something that had been going on in my life since I was aware of my sexuality and the struggle that I put up with. You know, at the age of 17 years, after going through religious curing process, I attempted my first suicide. As a 17-year-old boy, disillusioned, angry, upset, and feeling guilty for being who he was at that age, without no answer, lived in a community or in an environment where the only answer I could get from people is that something is wrong with me and that I will end up in hellfire. I come from a religious family, and I was struggling with that. It was a very huge thing for me. You know, I always tell myself, you know, what if I've been successful that day, that afternoon when I got back from school and I went into the bathroom and I tied a towel around my neck and I'm not here anymore, but I'm here. And I think that was what started the process. So from that period, I started trying to get to know myself. I was working myself through it. And by the time I was 18, I attended my first gay party. All my life, I've thought I was alone. And all of a sudden, I realized that, wow, wait a minute, I am not alone. There's nothing wrong with me. You know, these are people that are like me. These are people that have the same feeling like me. And I could be here. I can be free. I can have this party. I can talk to these people. And I feel extremely liberated that from there, I keep on digging and learning, going through the process of learning to love myself. I've always wanted to be an actor. So when I had the opportunity to go to university to study theater arts, it was for me a dream come true. But unfortunately, it was also the dream that exposed me to having to come out when the newspaper were going to out me. And this whole process was going back in my life again. I became suicidal again. And I remembered I was being told either to go and get married and just cover everything up, have children, or keep denying it, or just come out knowing that that would be the end of my career. I chose to come out. I didn't want to lie to anybody. I didn't want to lie to any woman. That cost me a lot of things. But also, you know, you talked about the danger of being gay in Nigeria. I experienced it all along. Playground bullying, you know, assault, you know, just mentioning, beaten up, arrested. I was used to it, that even when coming out and experiencing the backlash, it was like, this is what I'm expecting. This is what my life has always been like since I was 15. So there's really no big deal to it.
Is it a little weird talking about this so many years later, especially that particular moment of coming out on the couch, as you were saying?
Okay, this is something I've never talked about before that I am doing at the moment. I'm writing a letter to that 17-year-old boy and basically apologizing to him that I'm really sorry. I didn't know that you could have this potential. I didn't know that you have this story to tell. I'm sorry that I wanted to shut you up at that time. And I think talking about this, what it has helped me is to say that sometimes I might not be able to put those things into words. But when I talk about my experience with suicide and depression, it's just me talking to that 17-year-old and, you know, keep apologizing for what I've done. Yeah, it's very traumatic sometimes. It's very challenging. It's very disturbing. But it's also a way for me to clear my conscience. I deal with the underlyings that I'm struggling with.
The journey continues.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about your work with HIV and AIDS, but first, can you tell me a little bit about your life in London?
I think, you know, I'm always grateful to the British government for giving me a second chance in life, because when I was attacked in 2007 and my heart was broken into, if I had nowhere to run to, I would have been dead by now. But I had a place to run to, but not just run. I had a place that welcomed me and gave me citizenship and allowed me to be part of, you know, the country and call the country my home. So for that, you know, I'm very grateful. And, you know, I've given a lot of my time to not just being part of the system here, but to also shaping the system here. And I've been involved in talking about something that I'm very passionate about, and it's about race relations and how that impacts on sexuality. So I talk a lot about intersectionality, you know, the plight of a Black woman, the plight of a Black man, the intersectionality of a Black queer person, which most times are missed out in the bigger discourse of gender, race, and sexuality. So I do a lot of this here because the moment I stepped into this country, I stopped being just a Nigerian. I became Black. And I have to also understand the challenges that comes with being a Black gay man in a Western world. So there are different dynamics. And I learned that. But it's been amazing. I've been involved in politics. I did my master's while I was here. And come November this year, I'll be getting married to a fantastic man.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Was that something you thought you'd ever be able to experience?
No. You know, growing up and seeing how, you know, it's just about last week, the Netherlands celebrated 20 years of civil partnership. I was 21 years old when the first gay couple in the world were ever allowed to get married, and they were in the Netherlands. And at 21, that's not what you think of as a gay man growing up in Nigeria. You know, I left Nigeria when I was 32. I never thought I would ever, ever in my life be able to fall in love with somebody and say, I want to marry them. Yeah, we fall in love, but our love is best expressed by, you know, marrying a woman and spending time alone, sneaking out of everyone and hooking up with boys around the corner or in our cars. But for me to be able to have this kind of home, and I think that's also informed, You know, there's a sense of guilt that I feel that if this is good enough for me, then this should be good enough for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in Nigeria and across Africa as well.
Well, Bizi Alimi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me, and have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Bizi Alimi is from Nigeria and lives in London. I talked with him by Skype. This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. Spotlight Health is our six-part series on the top current health issues. To keep up with this and other Aspen Public Radio shows, like Mountain Edition, Valley Roundup, or Curated, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Vivian Ming knows what it's like to be a person who doesn't fit in. She was born male and has gone through a long journey. These days, Ming is CEO at an education company called Socos Learning. As a scientist, Ming has calculated exactly how much it can cost people to not fully realize who they are. She's passionate about maximizing human potential. We also spoke by Skype, and I asked her what maximizing human potential really means.
You know, it sounds a bit like a catchphrase, but from my background, I'm a hard numbers scientist. So what it really amounts to is, what can we do very concretely in health technology, in education, in labor economics, in issues of diversity, to really make certain that everyone lives out the best life that they could have had. It seems, in that sense, pretty simple and uncontroversial, but how that actually plays out with my work in machine learning and neuroprosthetics and big data analysis can sometimes be, I hope, impactful.
Tell me a little bit more, and it sounds like at least part of this stems from your own experience.
Yeah, there's this amazing research literature on life outcomes, looking at experiences and, as they say in the research, interventions you can run that can have a profound impact on someone's life. And those impacts can lead and have led to these amazing findings, such as an intervention that was run in the slums of Kingston, Jamaica. And 20 years later, those kids earned 25% more and literally lived longer. And I think about a world in which everyone has a chance to contribute at that level. And a lot of this does come from my own life. I was, unfortunately for my parents, not a particularly good student, unless you counted number of hours slept during class. I was pretty unhappy. I was very depressed for most of my life. After nearly flunking out of high school, I did flunk out of college and then pretty much dropped out of life and found myself in the mid-90s living out of my car and contemplating ending my life. There's no super clean story to this, but I don't want to take the whole time we have talking about it. In the end, I decided not to kill myself and really made a commitment to the kind of work that I do now, that as I often say, I wanted to live a life of substance. And that required 5 years of crawling back out of this hole I dug myself into, going back to school, having, frankly, astonishing success, unlike anything I'd ever had before, and then becoming an entrepreneur and meeting the person I love. And for those of you who've never heard my story before, finally being able to live as the person I wanted to after going through gender transition. The reason those two stories dovetail, the one about people living out their best life story and mine, is the simple fact that all of the amazing things I've had the privilege of doing over the last 10 years of my life, none of them should have happened. Despite all the privilege I was born into, despite all the advantages I had, You shouldn't have bet on me being alive at age 30, much less doing anything useful. And I wonder how many kids could be doing what I'm doing. How many could be having a positive impact on the world, but they didn't have 1,000 chances like I did. They didn't have 3. Maybe, despite what we tend to think in Silicon Valley about meritocracy, maybe they didn't even have 1 chance. And I'm feeling kind of selfish about this. I want to live in a world where everybody has a chance, where we all take an ownership of everyone else and the outcomes in their lives. And that's what really drives me and why I'm happy to work in so many different fields. Anything that has an impact is worth anyone's time.
The Advocate described your work at SOCOS as steps to revolutionize the way that student capabilities are measured and addressed. And what does that mean, keeping in mind that vision that you have for a world where people can be themselves and therefore will be more productive and happier?
Well, let's start by redefining what education is, and in a way which won't be initially controversial at all. Education should be about producing happy, healthy, productive people and letting society reap the benefits. I am happy to say that I stole that liberally from the Gates Foundation, and I believe in it. What I think makes it much more substantial, though, and possibly controversial, is I mean that explicitly. We can, leveraging big data technology and machine learning, we can and should make decisions about education and children's lives based on where we see them going with respect to health and happiness and the impact they can have. So at SOCOS, for example, we've built a tool called Muse. And with Muse, we can, for example, if I pick my daughter up from school today, the first thing she's going to do is tell me a story. I can hit a button and grab 30 seconds of her talking to me or 5 minutes of us reading in bed tonight. When I pick up my son and we get home, he's going to break out a pen and a piece of paper and draw. He just loves it. And I can grab a photo of that to share with his grandmother, but I can CC Muse. Along with those capabilities, we take 1 question a day, typically yes, no, that Muse just sends off to parents. And from that single question, and then whatever else they're willing to share, we very literally make predictions about kids' life outcomes, but not because we want to share it with anyone. Instead, all we want to do is send a single activity home every night. Parents, here's the one thing you can do tonight with your child that will have the biggest impact on their life. So to boil it down, we give parents a single targeted activity that they can do with their kid every night that has been driven by quite literally decades of life outcomes research and is designed to, if you don't mind the wild aspiration here, to maximize the life outcomes of their children.
It's so interesting because I immediately think of 2 things. Brave New World with kids in the, I think it's A, B, and maybe there's C's too, but different categories. And therefore,
I remember reading that and talking about why would anyone want to be an F? That had to get explained to me.
And then also I think of this culture of expecting parents to, I guess, maximize their own potential as parents and be the best they can be and you know, enrich their kids' lives every moment and kind of the pressure that comes with that. So tell me a little bit about your thoughts on both of those.
I think both are fair to look at as having some real substance. You know, the capabilities, not just what we're talking about, but the capabilities of big data and machine learning. And then my own personal research in the world of neuroprosthetics, which are about brain implants. And that should sound as scary as it might feel. We shouldn't accept any technology without thinking hard about it. And in fact, one of the things we discovered with our research, and many others have as well, is if you make those predictions, however accurate they are, they often only make things worse. So if I tell someone, hey, your kid's going to win a Nobel Prize, it actually makes it less likely to happen. And if I say your child's going to drop out of third grade, it makes it more likely to happen. So there can be some real unintended consequences from this kind of research. It's sort of well known in the scientific community, but not as well known maybe among practitioners and educational technologists. So we take it very seriously. The flip side of that, though, is, you know, I'm not trying to turn every kid into a banker. I'm not trying to, you know, my wife is an amazing woman. It was math camp every summer and first chair violin and off to Harvard and all of those sorts of experiences. I'm simply saying we've studied the things that actually predict life outcomes. And it turns out it's not grades. It's not standardized test scores. It has very little to do with what college you happen to go to. It's about what we call meta-learning, language development. It's about understanding the emotions of others. It's about creative problem solving and having a growth mindset and these many, many other really substantial attributes that it turns out you can develop in a young child. Our goal is to try and help parents give that to their kids as much as possible. What those kids do with it, I would be more than happy to let them figure that out for themselves. They want to be an artist or a skateboarder or a doctor. I just want them to be ready, not just for the life that's ahead of them, but for a world that has, let's be frank, a lot of technology that can do a lot of jobs for us. And maybe what will be left for people to contribute on is this much more substantive and crucial world of, for lack of a better term, problem solving. I want to build a world full of problem solvers. Let them go choose the problems to solve. Let them choose the solutions. The other side of it is, we talked about the parenting element. I had this line. I recently gave a talk for TEDMED, and I had a line in it that was, sorry, Tiger Moms, but it's actually you as role model, not as dictator, that predicts the life outcomes of your children. So here's my number one piece of advice for being a parent, one that I struggle with all the time. The best thing you can do is to be the best person you can be and model that for your kids. So one of the big points of intervention for us is actually trying to reduce stress in the household, not increase it.
Interesting. So not necessarily saying, by God, you must do this one activity, otherwise you're behind in life and the education of your child, but almost a problem solver activity in a way.
Yeah, I'd rather create, and, you know, I had this wonderful experience. I've been using the system myself, and you'd think, having built it, what could I possibly gain? I thought that myself, to be perfectly honest. And then first I had the nice thing of like, wow, every night I don't have to sweat it out. Like, there's just something, one little thing I can do for 20 minutes, a half an hour with my son and with my daughter. But this is the one that really got me. One of our interventions was, which I did not write, tonight, as you're reading with your son, stop halfway through and have him predict the ending of the book. And that was a lot of fun to do with him. But what I loved was a few weeks later, after having done that intervention a few times, he just started spontaneously doing that himself and was... Sometimes he was wrong, but the truth is most of the time, even creatively, when I was telling stories that I was making up in the moment, he could guess where they were going. And, oh, there was something so amazing about having built something myself that I could see the change that it was making in my own child.
Vivian Ming is with the company Socos Learning. We'll continue after a short break. You are listening to Spotlight Health from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a full version on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Let's get back to our conversation with scientist and inventor Vivian Ming.
People often ask me after I've given a talk, what could Muse have possibly have predicted and told your parents? And I admit, I might have been a bit of an outlier in some circumstances, but here's something simple it could have said, and I know it can. It's going to be okay. Don't worry that she isn't getting perfect scores in every class. You know, what I really needed was support. So now that ties into an area of my research, which is, if you don't mind my getting a little wonky, it's about endogenous motivation, that drive that comes from within, which is opposed to exogenous motivation, the sensitivity to praise and punishment and rewards. So it turns out endogenous motivation, as I could cite paper after paper after paper, it is a huge predictor of life outcomes. When you do it for yourself, for your own reasons and your own motivations, or I'm going to get even more arcane in my language, when you are incentive insensitive, it turns out, looking at a database we created of 122 million people, that was one of the principal predictors of their career outcomes, of their health outcomes, and of the development of young children. So yeah, as a parent, not only is part of your job letting go over time, but really helping your child to come in the end to do things because they believe in them, to do things because they're right, even when their boss tells them differently, even when their teacher says, no, you're wrong. If you can hear what they're saying and still see the rightness in what you're doing and move forward on it, as long as you don't take it to pathological levels, this is a huge, huge step forward. It's something I certainly needed more strongly when I was young. And, nowadays it seems trivial for me to say, hey, you know, who cares what your boss says? Do the right thing. When I did my dissertation in graduate school, which ended up being getting a lot of attention and being fairly high profile, all of my advisors had told me not to do it. And building that confidence, doing it for you, ends up being as powerful a skill as a parent could give their child.
Well, Vivian Ming, thanks so much for taking the time to talk.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Vivian Ming is CEO and co-founder of the education company Socos Learning. I talked with her via Skype. I'm Elise Thatcher, and that's all for our latest Spotlight Health episode. If you like the music you're hearing behind me right now, check out The Reflex on SoundCloud. You can listen to this and our following Spotlight Health episodes on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.